All of us, no doubt, remember the famous speech of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., where he stood up and he said, "I have a dream." The "I have a dream" speech. And that speech struck a chord with a lot of people because when you think about the content of it, what he said, how can you argue with it? You can't. There's no place to go. He said that his dream was for his four little children to live in a world wherein a person is judged not by the color of his skin, but by the content of his character. So who can say, "Oh no, that's not right"? No, you can't say that, can you? Now, certainly that is a universal truism, and it is a goal that every civilization should strive for. So we all remember that very well. And yet, in today's world, what do we see? We see Dr. King's vision being shattered because we're no longer judging each other on the basis of content of character. I say we, I'm talking about people, not people in this room, people out there. But it's on the basis of color, race, gender, sexual identity, anything but content of character. So I say Dr. King's vision, which is a wonderful vision, is being turned on its head and shattered. Well, today, with all of this racial strife and all the things we're seeing in the news out there, I thought it would take a biblical look at race, at racial matters, and what God expects. And also, we're going to see in this, as we begin reading back in Genesis chapter 6, if you'd like to turn back there, we're going to see what begins to emerge here is, I believe, a very powerful, very important, and a central theological truth starts to emerge. And it comes to full bloom in the New Testament, so we'll explore that and follow it all the way through. Obviously, we'll have to skip over a lot of material that would be relevant, otherwise we would be here all day. So back in Genesis chapter 6, I also want to dispel some myths about racial matters in relationship to the Bible. In Genesis chapter 6, verse 1, when man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were attractive. And they took as their wives any they chose. Now, this is a controversial passage, believe it or not. Because some people believe the sons of God here are angels. I don't believe that for one moment, not for a moment. I do not believe angels have reproduced, have married women, human women, not at all. The sons of God, some take this to mean, I've always thought there was some plausibility to the argument that these were the sons of Seth, and that because these were the people who called upon the name of God. They were therefore sons of God, as we today are children of God, if we have the Spirit of God residing in us. And they began to take wives from the daughters of men of all they chose, including those who were not in the, you know, among the righteous. And the unrighteous had a greater influence upon the righteous, and so on. You know the story, until great wickedness was found in the earth. But there's another way of understanding this, and that is sons of God. You remember Adam is simply called son of God, because God made him directly. Where did Eve come from? He made her too, but out of Adam. So she's in one sense the daughter of man. So sons of God and daughters of men could simply be a Hebrew idiom for men and women. So men began to multiply in the earth, they were already doing that, but they were looking upon the daughters of men, looking upon women and finding them very attractive and taking wives of all that they chose. That may be a reference to possibly to polygamy. Don't know. It certainly fits that scenario. It sounds like that's what's going on here. But then in verse 3 says, "Then the Lord said, My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh, his days shall be 120 years. Doesn't mean he'll cut down the lifespan, it means his days, mankind's days, 120 years. And then I'm going to deal with them. Now, one interpretation of this is that what God, you wonder that, you look at this, say, well, why is God so angry with man? Why is he so upset? What is going on here? The sons of God taking wives from the daughters of men of all they chose. Now, some of you may have heard this old interpretation, but it's out there. And I think it's still out there. And that what God angered God so much was this was interracial marriage. You ever heard that one? It's out there. That this was interracial marriage. And yet you look at it, it says absolutely nothing about anybody's skin color up to this point, does it? Doesn't say anything about race. It just assumes mankind is mankind. Period. Nothing there about race. But anyway, that is something that's out there. And I'll say it's bunk. Pay no attention to it. There's absolutely no evidence that such a thing was. Or that's, you know, that you can even interpret that this way. But I think the text tells us, it goes on to tell us what the problem was. God says, my spirit shall not abide in man forever for his in his flesh. His day shall be 120 years. It says the Nephilim, the giants, as it says in some translations, were in the earth in those days. And also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, that they bore children to them. It's just, and then it tells who these were. It says, these were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. This is not talking about mutants. It's talking about powerful, mighty men, people who probably had become tyrants. And now then there was trouble as a result of this, and it goes on to tell you what the trouble was. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. There's your problem. You don't need intermarriages with angels to get that. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animal and creeping things and birds and heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Now what was it about Noah that made God, caused God to favor him? These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generations. Now, this translation, that generation is singular. Blameless in his generation. If you're reading the King James, it probably has generation in the plural, does it? In his generations. Once had somebody explain to me, say, you see that what that's talking about? Genetics. In his generations, he was perfect in his generations, mean he was not mixed. Not genetically mixed. He hadn't been involved, his family hadn't been involved in this race mixing that caused all this problem. Well, that's nonsense. It does not mean that at all. Understand it this way. And this person, particular person, emphasized generations. Generations. Well, the thing is, you know, when Noah was alive, his father was also alive. And his grandfather was alive. You remember how long they lived back then? And his great-grandfather. All these generations were alive at the same time. And Noah, out of all these generations living at the same time, was righteous. That's what it means. It means he was obedient to God. Has nothing to do with his genetics. Nothing to do with race mixing or any such thing of the kind. In fact, there's only the one race, as far as I can see. It's called the human race. It's called man here in Scripture. And that's all you have. You can't read any more into that than what is clearly there. He goes on to say, Noah walked with God. That's what it means to be righteous in your generations. He walked with God, and Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, these three sons and their wives, and Noah and Mrs. Noah, they all went aboard the ark when the flood came. Okay? Now, it has been said that Shem married a white woman, and that Ham was married to a black woman, and that Japheth was married to what we now would call an Asian person. Okay? Where do you get that? Where does it say that? It doesn't say it anywhere, does it? It doesn't say anything about these distinctions among human beings at this point. My personal opinion is that such distinctions did not yet exist. But that's what you get here. That's what people think. Now, my question, though, is the same people would tell you the reason God destroyed the earth was because of race mixing, and now he's going to take all this, take Shem, Ham, and Japheth, who are interracially married, and perpetuate this great sin through the flood. That doesn't make any sense, does it? No sense whatsoever. It's dumb. So no, this is none of that had anything to do with racial matters. It's just that's some nonsense that's out there. I don't know who came up with all this stuff, but it is actually out there. And it says, now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was, here's your problem, filled with violence. There's your problem. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. Their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh. And of course, you know the story from there, that Noah and his sons and their wives and the animals that God had designated were taken aboard the ark, and so mankind was preserved. Now, in my opinion, the entirety of the human race was, at that point, hadn't extended much beyond the Mediterranean, that area. The Mediterranean area there, at the Mediterranean Sea and so on. It hadn't gone into Europe, hadn't gone down into sub-Saharan Africa. I doubt if there was a sub-Saharan Africa. I don't think there was probably not a Sahara Desert at that point. But they had not spread out that far. So my suspicion is that pretty much the whole human race looked basically alike. Didn't look like you had Europeans and sub-Saharan Africans and Asians and whatever else was in the mix. Nowadays, of course, now, way beyond the flood that man has spread out all over the world, you see all kinds of variations, and these all came from one source. You know, you can cross the continent of Africa, for example, sub-Saharan Africa, and you find all kinds of different people who look very different. They have some common features. Most of them have a high level of melanin in their skins. But you have tribes down there that are very tall. One tribe, the average is 6'3". That's the average, not for men, but for the whole, for everybody. You have some really tall women and men, extremely tall men down there in that one tribe. And on the other hand, you have the pygmies. The pygmies. And their average height is 4'9". That's a huge difference. So you have in this genetic potential of the three sons of Noah, you have all of this. This did come out of that. The genetic potential is there. So you have all these various different variations of human beings coming forth from there. Now, so thus far, we don't see anything about, some people read this, the sin of race mixing in there. It's not there. In fact, you can look throughout the Bible, and you will not find that listed as a sin. It's not. When you go to the book of, you go to Nehemiah, the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, you do find where they were committed, the men of Israel who'd married these foreign wives were commanded to separate from them. A lot of people read race into that. But you know what the truth is? You read the text, it tells you exactly why they were commanded to separate from their foreign wives. It wasn't because they were a different color from them. Some of them may have been, but maybe not. But we don't know. Scripture doesn't take up that as an issue. But the reason is because they were marrying idolatrous women, and they were saying, Ezra, Nehemiah, other leaders are saying, look, you're going to put yourself right back in the same set of circumstances that got you kicked out of the land to begin with. Now here you are back here, and you're beginning to do the same things by bringing in this foreign religions, this idolatrous worship, and you're going to get run off again. That was the problem. Had nothing to do with race mixing or any such thing. That is not a sin. That's not a sin for human beings who are different, who look different, who have different levels of melanin in their skins to marry each other. as long as it's male and female. Understand? Yeah. Now then, with all that in mind, let's go to. We're going to see the unfolding of a very, very important, a centrally important theological theme. And I believe the scripture is put together in such a way, we are told, the Apostle Paul tells us that it is God-breathed. It's not just a collection of books that somebody decided to say, hey, well, this fits well, this fits well. No, God is behind it all. Ultimately, God is the author. It is God-breathed, and God, I believe, has within the text these themes that if you follow them through, you will see them develop and unfold and then come to full bloom. Here's one of them, and it has to do with the families of the earth. It has to do with the different races of human beings that we find on the earth today. Now let's go to Exodus chapter 12. This is a very familiar passage because we read it every year at Passover time. Exodus, the 12th chapter, and we'll just break into the thought. You already know all about this anyway. Look at verse 37. It says, and the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses. This is at the Exodus. This is after the death angel had passed over. The Pharaoh has released the people. The people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. Now the word thousand here, just as an aside, some say that the word thousand would be better rendered families, or perhaps it refers to segments of tribes, and it may not be necessarily rendered thousand, but others say, no, it is correctly rendered thousand. But the reason some people question this is because they think 600,000, this is talking about the men of military age, and then not counting everybody else. So that is a massive number of people if that's the case. And so many would say, well, this is just too many. But really, you consider the fact they'd been there four centuries, and you start doing the math, it very well could be that many. So that's not an issue with me one way or the other. I'll just say it's a big old bunch of people, a lot of them, a lot of them. And it says, and this is what I want to focus on here. Very important. I think this is what we find here is what begins to emerge from this is a theological message. It'll later come to full bloom. A mixed multitude also went up with them, and very much livestock in both flocks and herds. The mixed multitude. Who is that? Who were they? Well, it doesn't really spell it out for us, but we do know who the peoples were that were in and out of Egypt. Others who came to Egypt, lived in Egypt. Of course, you had Egyptians there in Egypt, of course. So some of the Egyptian sympathizers, no doubt, were in that multitude. And without a doubt, many of the people from the kingdom of Cush to the south were there. Now, if you're familiar with the Cushites, that would be the Ethiopians, the people south of Egypt. These were definitely black people, what we call black, sub-Saharan African peoples. And the Egyptians, now let me explain this before I go further with this. There was a time, this controversy, you have extremes. There was a time when certain archaeologists, I suppose, or commentators, I don't know, certain people, and some people still do this, claimed that the sub-Saharan peoples never produced anything of great value. In other words, they didn't produce great kingdoms like other nations did. Well, that's false. That is false. We know for sure that is false. The assumption is that anything you see great going on in sub-Saharan Africa was given to them by some other people, or somebody else helped them get that started. But we know that is false. We know, in fact, that the kingdom of Cush, that it was at one time, it rivaled Egypt in greatness. They had pyramids, they were an advanced society, and they were not the only ones. What people do, they will look at a certain part of Africa, maybe at West Africa, where there are primitive peoples there, similar to the peoples you find in South America. the rainforest and so on. And then they assume that all sub-Saharan Africa is that way. We know from history, we know for sure. Take off any kind of prejudiced glasses you may be looking at things through, and you'll see, no. There were great kingdoms in sub-Saharan Africa. And this particular one I'm referring to, the kingdom of Cush, they were the descendants of Cush, the son of Ham, and they were in that very hot region. You go to, the closer people get to the equator, you notice their skin becomes darker. When they move away toward Europe, they become lighter, don't they? Well, that's adaptation, but nevertheless, what you find there are these people. The kingdom of Cush, it did rival Egypt at one point, and in fact, there were times when they were allies. They had friendly relationships. And there were trade routes in and out of there, all the way up into the Arab world, and Arabs were familiar with the Cushites, and Egyptians, of course, and there was this trade and interaction going on between these peoples all the time. So therefore, there would have been, no doubt, Cushites in the land of Egypt. But all the Egyptians were not Cushites. The vast majority of Egyptians were. They looked pretty much like what, if you take a look at, sometime do a Google search for people of Lebanon, people of from the Levant, Middle Eastern peoples, Arabs. They looked like that. They were brown. Now, it's interesting. I had a discussion with a black friend of mine, and I'm not sure he's still a friend after the discussion, but he was making the claim. He got this from the group called, actually it's not just one group, there's a bunch of groups called this, but Hebrew Israelites. And their claim was that the Egyptians were black. And I said, well, black people lived in Egypt, no question about that, the people from down south. But we also see all this evidence, also DNA evidence, that the Egyptians, for the most part, were brown. And in fact, I went on to say this, that I agree. The Egyptians were not, they didn't look like the people you see in the Ten Commandments. They were not blue-eyed, were not blonde-haired, and didn't have skin that looks like mine. I agree with it. Oh, and Jesus didn't have blue eyes. He didn't look European. He didn't look like me. Even though some of you remember from the old building we used to meet in, everybody joked about, some of you don't know this, but those of you who met in the old building with all those pictures of Jesus, they used to jokingly say that that was me in my college days. Well, he didn't really look like me. He was not blue-eyed. We know that. But neither did he look like someone from sub-Saharan Africa. He looked like a Middle Eastern Jew. Brown eyes, dark skin, brown skin, not real dark, but, brown. You know what the people there look like. And either way, I was having a discussion with my friend, and I said, yeah, I agree, they were not white, but they were not black. Now, what do I mean by white and black? Black, usually, most of us, when we say that, we're talking about people of sub-Saharan descent. Okay? White, we usually mean people from European descent, don't we? And most of us put the brown peoples, we don't call them white, but we don't call them black either, do we? That's most of us. And I said, the Egyptians were not white. And I said, the Israelites were not white. And then he wrote back to me, and he said something about my proclivity toward white superiority. I said, huh? I said, what part of not white do you not understand? So I was saying, no, they were not white, they were brown. They were brown. We have DNA evidence from the ancient Egyptians. They were actually able to sequence some of the DNA from some of these ancient mummies going back 1,300 years ago, and they were the same, essentially the same peoples you find throughout the Near East. The same, I don't know how the DNA works, but, they were actually able to. They thought they couldn't do it, but they did it. And you see some of the mummies that are clearly from the sub-Saharan region. Say, well, what about those? Aren't those black pharaohs? Yes, indeed they were. They were the Nubians who conquered Egypt later in their history. They conquered Egypt, and for a short time there were Nubian pharaohs. And then the Assyrians came and conquered them, removed them, and put the original rulers back in charge. So yeah, you have all of that. But there again, sometimes you have a segment of history being interpreted in a way to make the whole history appear to be that way. But no, you had all of that. You had these different peoples there. You had the brown people. You definitely had the sub-Saharan peoples who had trade, interactions with them. And so this mixed multitude, my point here, the mixed multitude without a doubt included a variety of people. I don't know how many came down from farther north, if there were any lighter skins there. Not sure. We're not told. We just know it's a mixed multitude. And then this is why we're told, just in a few verses later, it says, verse 43, and the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the statute of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it. This has in mind the mixed multitude now. But every slave that is bought for money may eat of it after you have circumcised him. No foreigner or hired servant may eat of it. It shall be eaten in one house. And let me just skip on down to verse 48. If a stranger shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land. So what this has in view are those people who are not Israelites according to the flesh, the mixed multitude who went out with them. And here he's establishing this principle that will be carried on. And that is simply that any foreigner who comes among you may become one of you and be treated as a fellow citizen, but this is what he has to do first. It's as simple as that. Now, this, as I said, this mixed multitude, I think this is foundational to an emerging theology, and let's see it begin to play out. We're going to skip across a lot of material, but go over to Numbers chapter 12, and we're going to see an interesting interracial marriage here. Numbers 12. It says, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married. Here's Moses, without a doubt, a brown person, an Israelite, and he marries a woman, a Cushite or Ethiopian, someone from the south. In other words, he marries a black woman. Okay? Now, does God condemn that relationship? No. He deals with the ones who are criticizing him. Notice what he says. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? This is what Miriam and Aaron are saying. Has he not spoken through us also? And this was all in view of the fact that he'd married this Cushite woman, and they didn't care for that. They didn't like it very much. Now the man Moses was very meek, more than all people who were on the face of the earth. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tent of meeting. And the three of them came out, and the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forward. And he said, hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. Notice, he is faithful in all my house. With him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly, and not in riddles. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, not Moses, and he departed. When the cloud removed from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous like snow. In other words, you've criticized my servant Moses for his marriage to this black woman. Therefore, you're claiming, well, good God worked through us too? And God turned her real white. A little bit ironic there, isn't it? And Aaron turned toward Miriam, and behold, she was leprous. And Aaron said to Moses, "Oh, my Lord, do not punish us because we have done foolishly and have sinned. Let her not be as one dead, whose flesh is half eaten away when he comes out of his mother's womb." And Moses cried to the Lord, "Oh, God, please heal her, please." And the Lord said to Moses, "If her father had but spit in her face, should she not be shamed 7 days?" He's talking about putting them outside the camp as punishment. "Let her be shut outside the camp 7 days. And after that she may be brought in again." So Miriam was shut outside the camp 7 days, and the people did not set out on the march till Miriam was brought in again. Now, there's the theological message. You may miss it. This continues the theme. You may miss it just by reading the surface. But notice, Miriam was the sister of Moses. And you see how God viewed Moses. This was his sister. She was an Israelite. And yet, this Israelite is put out of the camp, in a sense, under condemnation, at least for a time, while this Cushite woman is in the camp and is counted as a fellow Israelite. You see that? You see what's going on here? There's a theological message beginning to come forth, and it comes to full bloom in the New Testament. So it's not so much about it. It is not about skin color at all, is it? No, it is about content of character. It's about obedience to God. And again, this message will come forth more fully in the New Testament. Well, let's go over there now. Take a look at that. Go to Revelation. Now, I was going to say something earlier about how some erroneously have claimed that there were no great kingdoms in the sub-Saharan African region, and how that at one point it was assumed by some that that was the case, but then there was a reaction to it, and some started to say, no, everything, all great achievements were accomplished by sub-Saharan peoples. Both of those extremes are wrong. They're both wrong. That's not the case at all. There were great achievements in sub-Saharan, among sub-Saharan peoples. There were great kingdoms that came out of there. And but also the reaction to that is also wrong. That's the other extreme. It has been claimed by some revisionists, for example, that the great Greek philosophers, Plato, Socrates, etc., that they really stole their material from the black people who were there before them. No, they didn't. They didn't. They made that stuff up themselves. But the philosopher, and there's the claims that Cleopatra was really black. No, she wasn't. She wasn't. All of these are extremes, and you have one end to the other, and they're all wrong. They're all wrong. The fact is that you do have sub-Saharan peoples who achieve great things, and you also have many of the brown peoples who achieve great things, and the white Europeans as well, the lighter skinned Europeans that came along, and the philosophers were Greeks. And another thing I wanted to mention too, and it slipped by, but my friend, one of his points was that since the Egyptians were black, then when Pharaoh's daughter took the infant Moses, or the young Moses, into her home, that it wouldn't have worked had he been white. And I said, well, that perhaps that's the case, but see, she wasn't black and he wasn't white. They were all brown. They were brown. And nobody thought anything about that. And besides that, Moses' identity was known. But anyway, she was Pharaoh's daughter. She can do basically what she wants to. But in any case, the other argument was when that he made was when Joseph and Mary and the infant Jesus fled from Herod and went into Egypt. Said, well, they went there to blend in. And Egyptians, as he said, as everybody knows, they were black. And so they were this holy family went there to blend in, so they must have been black too. I said, in response to that, I basically said, you mean there were no brown people there? That's absurd. You mean there were no Greeks and Romans there during that period? I think you find all kinds of people all over the place in that world. So that all of that stuff, all those arguments are absurd. And we know that what Jesus looked like, as I said, he did not look like me in my college days. He did not look, he was not European looking. He was brown, had no doubt brown skin, brown eyes, looked like a Middle Eastern Jew. You know, and a lot of Jews today look just that way. You may notice it if you look at them. I've known some, and that's exactly what they look like. You say, where did all these white Jews come from? Well, they're mixed with Europeans. The Ashkenazi Jews, you know, lived in Europe for such a long time, and you know, there's some mixture there. But in any case, that's what you have there. Now, you see this again. You see this theological theme developing. You see it. You see that throughout the prophets. We won't go to the various prophecies concerning this, but you notice that in the Messianic kingdom, you find sprinkled throughout those prophecies references to the nations, and these references to people outside of Israel. And not only will the Messianic reign affect Israel, not only will the Messiah bring Israel together, but he's also going to extend to the rest of the world. And thus you have the fulfillment of the promise given to Abraham from the very beginning, that in your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And you see that finally coming to fruition coming to full bloom in the New Testament. And we'll read about it. Let's go to Revelation chapter 7, John says in verse 9, after this, I looked and behold a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne. Did you notice who this is? Now this is a proleptic picture of the church, the true church, the true people of God. This is the true Israel of God. And it says that they come from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne. All peoples, all nations, all the families of the earth. Again, do we not see that theme beginning to develop back in the Old Testament? When the door is beginning to open to the nations, from the covenant people to the nations, Israel, to the nations. And then as you go through the prophets, you see again and again a reference to the nations being blessed under the Messianic reign. And so here you see it coming to full bloom. So these peoples from all nations and tongues and tribes are there before the throne. And all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, amen, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen. Then one of the elders addressed me, saying, who are these clothed in white robes, and from where have they come? I said to him, sir, you know. And he said to me, these are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night. Again, this is proleptic. It points to the future, not to something going on up in heaven during the tribulation period. Serve him in his temple, and he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat, for the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. And then finally you say, well, of course, this is talking about the first fruits harvest, the first fruits. And this first fruits, the true Israel of God, which is in the world today, but ultimately will be given immortality, comes from every tongue and tribe and people on the nation of the on the face of the earth. But ultimately what you're going to see is this extends to the entire world. And you see that in Revelation chapter 21, Revelation 21, where John says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with men. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them and be their God.'" This is the rest of the world. The rest of the world. When God himself comes down, when finally the kingdom, when all obstacles, when all oppositional powers are overthrown under the reign of Christ, and finally God himself, God the Father himself, comes to the earth and makes this his home, when he will dwell with men or with human beings, or the inhabitants of the world, and they will be his people, and he himself will be their God. "He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more, neither shall they be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more. For the former things have passed away." You know, and as I look at this world, and I look at all the terrible things going on in the world, I look at human beings being inhuman to other human beings, and I look at all the strife, all the wars, all the killings, everything that we see, all the negativity, it's depressing. Watch the news very long, it's very depressing. But these are words of hope. These are words of hope, because we know the time is coming when God is going to reverse all of that, when he's going to wipe away every tear from every eye, and the world will at long last be at one with God.